This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Hey, blessings around the world. I know we have listeners in many countries. Thank you for the emails, the affirmation, the guest suggestions. I'm excited about today's show because I wanted to touch on this topic and some of the, I would say, the branches that are tied into it. And I was very fortunate when the publisher sent me this book, which I really enjoyed. It's called Demystifying Sharia. What it is, how it works, and why it's not taking over our country. Can you imagine? And it's just like, we'll get into it. But the author's brilliant. She also wrote the book, The Muslim Next Door, which I read, and some other great stuff. What an honor to welcome to our family, officially, Sumbul Ali Karamali. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Now, I know you grew up in Los Angeles. Was it a religious household?
Oh, well, you know, my dad originally came from India in order to do his PhD at UC Santa Barbara. And then I grew up in Long Beach, just south of Los Angeles. And I would say, like, I always thought of ourselves as mainstream religious. So, yeah. So I was taught the kinds of things. I was taught the five pillars of Islam. I was taught the kinds of things that kids in a, you know, moderately religious household grow up with, which is, you know, how to pray, how to fast, give to charity, do your homework, respect your parents.
So the basics, basically.
Yeah.
Now, when I lived out in Beverly Hills for a while and in other parts of LA, to me, there seemed to be a beautiful coexistence between many religions there. I would go to a cafe and there'd be people talking across cultural. Was it like that when you were growing up? Was there much tension or was it pretty calm?
So I grew up in a fairly white middle class neighborhood. And so and actually, at the time, there weren't that many Muslims in California. This was just before a lot of the immigration quotas were relaxed and more immigrants started to come. And so I was often the first Muslim that people around me had ever met, believe it or not. And this was before the Iranian Revolution. And so Islam wasn't really thought about very much in the public discourse. People asked me how many gods I had. They asked me, are you black or are you white? Because they weren't really used to seeing in between brown-skinned people. And so I was usually the only one. And being the only one, I answered a lot of questions growing up. Like, what is Islam? What do you mean? And it didn't come up very much when I was a kid, because on the playground, you don't really talk about religion. But I hope. For example, if I went to a birthday party and they had pepperoni pizza, I'd have to say, well, I don't eat pepperoni because it's pork and I don't eat pork. And then I'd have to say, well, I don't eat pork because I'm Muslim. And that's generally how it came up. As I got older and started to fast during Ramadan, also I didn't go out on dates, then I would have to explain myself a bit more. And then when I went off to college, I went to Stanford and I lived in the dorm. And Paul, it was like an Interfaith 101 experience, because anyone who's lived in a dorm knows that you're all close together. Everyone knows what you're doing. And I was suddenly thinking, okay, how am I going to pray five times a day without my roommate noticing when she lives 2 feet away from me? Or how am I going to figure out if there's pork in the dorm food when nobody knows what's in the dorm food? So it was a whole new set of issues that came up.
And have you spent your life almost since then, and more, obviously it's become what you do, just explaining to people? And I imagine you must get some of the worst questions ever, because America, by and large, is pretty ignorant about other religions, I have found.
Well, so after college, I went to law school and did my law degree. And you're right. I mean, as I sort of moved along, Islam became more and more in the news. This was after the Iranian Revolution. The the Soviet Union had fallen apart, and so the communist threat was not so big anymore. And so, of course, you always need a threat. So Islam was kind of the new threat that came along. People asked me a lot of questions when I started working as a lawyer. I got all kinds of questions. Like, one of the partners sat me down when I was a baby lawyer, you know, just starting, and said, why are Muslims more violent than other kinds of people? Yes, I got all kinds of questions. But then what happened is that when my husband's job took us to London, I decided to do a degree in Islamic law from the University of London. And that was so interesting because I had grown up as a Muslim, but then I got this academic degree, which really sort of opened my mind to what Islam is. And I realized how much more fluid Islam is and open to interpretation and diverse than most people, even Muslims, think. So it was after that that I came home and I decided, you know, I've been asked all these questions my whole life. I want to write a book that answers the questions that people have always asked me, not a textbook. I don't want to write a textbook because nobody wants to read it. But I want to write the answers to everything that people wonder about and don't have anybody to ask.
And that was a great idea. Also, it saved you a ton of time. Now you can just say, buy the book, or that's on chapter 7. How much changed after 9/11 for you personally? And you probably still deal with the fallout.
Yeah. So some people assume, even Muslims assume, that 9/11 started the whole trend of anti-Muslim prejudice, let's say. You can call it Islamophobia, you can call it anti-Muslim racism, you can call it anti-Muslim prejudice in this country, but it had actually gone back much further than that. 9/11 exacerbated things. It was shocking and it was a terrible event. And so it had exacerbated the negative feelings about Muslims. But you know, the West has a long, long tradition of viewing Muslims as the enemy. It's not a new thing. European Christians didn't know anything about Islam in the 7th century when Islam was born. And so they assumed the worst. You know, they were Christians. So, of course, they thought, well, this is a false religion. It's the Antichrist. It's all kinds of terrible things. And they didn't really know any Muslims. And so they came up with a whole mythology of what they thought Muslims were like. And often they only met them on the battlefield. So in our culture, in our European culture, and in American culture, which we inherited from the Europeans, we have throughout our literature and historical narratives, we have a view of looking at Muslims as the enemy. The Iranian Revolution, when that happened, it just confirmed those views. Like, oh yeah, we remember Muslims are the enemy. And then 9/11 further confirmed, of course, the view. But the problem is that we've never really seen Muslims as anything other than the enemy. It's really hard to get past the conditioning. So in textbooks, in television, in movies, in our literature, in our history, there's a presumption that Muslims are different and Muslims are the enemy. It's a hard presumption to overcome. And of course, 9/11 made it harder.
Great answer, especially historically. And of course, when Islam came into being in the 7th century, it acknowledged the other religions. It was quite peaceful and acknowledged Christianity, Judaism, even paganism, and lived amongst those religions. And I read a couple books, I remember years ago, about the Crusades, which were brutal, killed maybe millions and were unprovoked. So you're right, it goes back forever. And every new religion becomes the unofficial cult, the bad guy, until the next one comes and the outsider. And I feel like really 9/11 was just a part of it. But I felt what I really hated about that and since is how so much of the right-wing evil media machine has used it, inflamed it, and made it worse just to manipulate people and use their fear to actually vote against their own interests. And it's going on to this day. Don't you feel? I feel like it's not just generically happen. I feel like it's actively being stoked and made worse.
I think it's really a useful narrative. I think it's for people who want power. It's really easy to call your opponents terrorists, right? So this is happening in India. It's happening in the Philippines. You know, anybody who is trying to oppose the government is, if they're called a terrorist, then it's really easy for the government to just crack down on them as part of the so-called war on terror. So that's been very sad. According to Physicians for, I think it's Physicians for Social Responsibility, they did a study, and they found that as many as 2 million Muslim civilians have died as a result of the U.S.'s war on terror since 9/11.
Wow. God, that really hit me in the stomach there. And yet they don't count them because literally they don't count.
That's right. They don't count. So, I mean, for the 3,000 or so people who died in 9/11, that was a horrible, tragic thing. And it should never have happened. And it was completely un-Islamic, by the way. Terrorism has always been a violation of Islam. Even early Islamic rules were very harsh on terrorism. And I'm defining terrorism as the clandestine use of force. So 9/11 was not jihad. It was not at all in line with any Islamic rules of law. It was violating Islamic law. So it was a terrible thing. But also the 2 million Muslim civilians who've died, you know, as a result of the U.S.'s war on terror, well, that's a terrible thing too.
Not only that, selling weapons to Iran and Iraq, arming Saudi Arabia, what's been going on in Yemen. I mean, I'm going to be honest, we're the bad guy. We're the empire. We're Darth Vader. I know we have a great PR department, but, and I don't hate America. I love America. That's why I tell the truth. That's why they call us the great Satan over there. And look at our relationship with Iran. We took out a democratically elected democratically elected leader who wanted to, yeah, in the 50s, and then we put the Shah in with his death squads that are trained at Fort Benning, like so many others. And then we wonder why they hate us because we're free. How ignorant and dumb is that? I mean, that to me is exhausting, and it must be twice as hard for someone, you know, who has to defend it like you do. I mean, because it's not fair.
Well, I do. It is sometimes hard to talk about this stuff because I sometimes feel like if I weren't Muslim, then I would probably have negative views of Muslims too. Because in fact, the majority of the country of Americans have negative views of Muslims, and I totally sympathize because we get it from everywhere. We get it from our media. We get it from our television and movies. I'll tell you, Paul, even random books that I read, even cookbooks, I've come across stereotypes of Muslims. And I've started to read science fiction in self-defense because there are no Muslims in science fiction for the most part. But it's hard to overcome that sort of conditioning. I wanted to say that there was a study out of Georgetown that said that 90% of stories about Muslims in our media are in the context of violence. So if you only hear about Muslims in the context of violence, then of course you're going to think that Muslims are always violent. Like if you only heard about Buddhists in the context of violence, then you would think that Buddhists were only violent.
And yet we walk around the block sideways to avoid the topic of white supremacy and what's going on in this country. Every time, and it's almost every time, a white male shoots up a ton of people, it's always a lovable loner who liked dogs as a kid, once helped an old lady across the street before later murdering her kids. And it's just sort of likable. And every white person doesn't have to answer to it. And if he was a born-again Christian and he had a Bible, they talk about that, but Christians don't have to answer. But the second, you know, it might have had darker skin, heaven forbid, now it's a terrorist and we need to, like, ban other countries from flying here.
Well, sometimes I do feel like I do feel despairing sometimes because I think it just takes one Muslim to commit a crime and it's portrayed as Islamic terrorism instead of just one criminal. And it's really hard. You know, there are probably 1.7 or 1.8 billion Muslims in the world. Of course, there are going to be some criminals. Like, you can't control everybody. And I mean, we have crime in New York City. It doesn't mean that all of New Yorkers are criminals.
What do you think about what's going on with white supremacy in this country and like things like the insurrection?
I'm hopeful, actually. And the reason I'm hopeful is because for the first time, I see it being acknowledged. For a long time, it wasn't acknowledged. Muslim terrorism is actually, terrorism committed by Muslims is actually a very, very small percentage of terrorism in this country. And you're right, white terrorism is the majority of it, and it was ignored. But for the first time this year, I felt hope that it was being acknowledged and addressed. And I also felt hope that the Black Lives Matter protests were acknowledged and taken to heart. And, I take the long view. I think it's really easy to point fingers at other groups, and it's human nature to point fingers at other groups and to forgive people in our own group. And we always have to fight that. You know, we always have to fight trying to be objective and trying not to be biased in favor of our own group. And we're all guilty of that. It's just, it's human nature. So it's going to be a couple steps forward, a couple steps back. But overall, if you take the long view, I think I am hopeful that we will start being able to walk in each other's shoes a bit more than we have. We haven't been a multi-religious country for very long. You know, people always say, oh, yes, of course we have. There have been Jews in this country. There have been other people. And that's not what I mean. I mean that we have, for the most part, it's been a Protestant country. When John F. Kennedy was running for president, people were very upset that he was Catholic. So it's only recently, really only since the 70s, that there's been more of an acknowledgement of other religions. And so in this country, I feel like we haven't really known how to talk about different religions objectively. When I was growing up, you're supposed to never talk about religion, or you're proselytized if you were a proselytizer. But my dad always told me, never talk about religion, politics, or other people's children. It was good advice. Yes, but and of course I'm breaking his strictures, because here I am talking about religion. But I think we didn't learn about religion in school either when I was growing up, and now every state has standards to learn about religion. You know, obviously they don't teach faith in our schools, but they teach about world religions, and I think that's really important, because it's impossible to understand humanity and human history without understanding something about world religions. And also, it increases tolerance. If you know what other people believe, then you're not making up tall tales about them, and you see them as people. So I think that's a hopeful thing, too.
That's incredibly hopeful and optimistic. Thank you for that. I think that's good. We need that, because it is grounded and it's a big picture perspective. Mm-hmm. Will you do the honors and demystify Sharia law?
I will do my best. Okay. So, they did a study. I can't remember who it was, but I read about a study a few years ago where they asked Muslims to define Sharia, and most of them couldn't do it. And it's because Sharia is an academic term. I didn't grow up with this word Sharia. Most of the people I knew didn't grow up with this word Sharia. In fact, childhood memories are imperfect, but I'm pretty sure I didn't even hear the word until I did my degree in Islamic law. What I tell people is that if you have 5 seconds and you need to define Sharia, just say, generally, it just means Islam. Because that's really generally what it means. Loosely, it means Islam. The problem with defining it more specifically is that it doesn't have a fixed meaning. literally, the word Sharia means the road to the watering place. And if you were born in the desert, the way Islam was, then the road to the watering place is the road that you want to be on. You want to be on the road to water. In religious terms, it means the road to righteousness, the road where you quench your spiritual thirst. So the path of righteousness, or you might say the path of God. That's what Sharia means, is the path of God. And that is divine, right? The path of God, whatever it is divine. For early Muslims, though, the question was, well, how do we know what the path of God is? How do we know what we're supposed to do to be on the path of God? So the early Muslims looked to the religious texts. They looked to the Quran, which is the Muslim holy book, and they looked to the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. And they looked to those religious texts to see what is right and what is wrong in the eyes of God. How do we stay on the path of God? Sometimes they didn't find the answers they wanted, and so they began interpreting the religious texts to find more answers and more religious guidelines. They filled books and books and books of opinions and debates and case studies and their posited answers to what they thought we should do to be on the path of God. And this whole body of interpretive literature is called fiqh. Sharia, which means the path of God, sometimes also includes the Quran and the Sunnah, because they are divine, so they are what puts us on the path of God. But sometimes Sharia refers to the Quran and the Sunnah and the fiqh, the interpretive literature. Now, the Quran and the Sunnah and the fiqh is the greater part of Islam, which is why Sharia just loosely means Islam. And I know this might be confusing, but again, Sharia can mean a couple different things. Most commonly, it does refer to the system of jurisprudence in Islam, which is the system of looking at the religious texts and coming up with more guidelines and more rules. Sharia is not law. And sometimes it's translated as Islamic law, but it's not law. So my Islamic law professor in England, who is not Muslim, by the way, he said Islamic law is a misnomer because Sharia is not law the way we think of law. It's not rigid and enforceable. It's a set of guidelines. And it's not one thing. If you say, well, what does the Sharia say about any point? The Sharia usually says a bunch of different things because it's comprised of lots of opinions and debates and arguments and case studies. So, and by the way, most of the Sharia, most of fiqh, really, the interpretive literature, has to do with personal conduct. Like, how do you pray? How do you fast? All the different religious rules of how you conduct your life personally to be on the path of God. Does that make sense, Paul?
That's a beautiful take. And I'm remembering, if I'm not incorrect, it sounds scary because you don't know what it is. It's being imposed. And weren't they saying if Barack Obama was elected, he was going to impose it because he was secretly a Muslim who was born in Africa? You're laughing. I cracked up too. It sounds like bad comedy writing. And then he was always coming to take the guns or he was going to impose that. I remember Sarah Palin was trying to say that.
Yeah.
And he was palling around with terrorists. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
used kind of as a weapon, but it's like, somebody could blow up a building and claim to be a representative for the Prophet Muhammad or whatever, but they're nuts. It has nothing to do with the religion, which is about peace and love, as far as I know it.
Every religion can be subverted for someone's own purposes, right? You can fight about anything that you want to fight about. I have to say, okay, I have to bring in Star Trek. I remember a Star Trek episode where Captain Kirk went to a planet and there were two people fighting and trying to kill each other, two men. And they each had half their face was white and half their face was black. And they were bent on killing each other. And Captain Kirk, who, by the way, was my first crush, Captain Kirk says to one of the men, well, why do you want to kill each other? And one of the men says, well, because of the way he looks. And Captain Kirk says, well, I don't understand. You both look the same. Your faces are half white and half black. And the alien says, are you blind? My face is white on the left side and his face is white on the right side. So human beings will fight over whatever there is to fight about.
I love Star Trek. And I heard a rumor before you came on that you were a Star Trek loving person. And I'm cracking up that you somehow worked it in.
Well, I can't help it. When I wrote my first book, I found all these Star Trek episodes kind of sidling into my consciousness, trying to get loose. And I thought, why am I thinking of Star Trek when I'm writing this book on religion? But Star Trek is about universal values and the human experience and social justice. And that's what religion is about, too, I think. All religions can be used. I mean, a religion is, one of my favorite sheikhs says, a text is only as moral as its reader, which is true. You know, this is not physics. It's not mathematics. It's religion. So they can always be subverted. But I do think that all religions were founded for the purpose of furthering justice.
And I love the episode of Star Trek analogy, too, because I always think, God, why do we need religions? All they do is create hate. But I thought we would just figure out a new way to hate and kill each other.
That's right. I mean, look at families. Families don't even get along, right? So that has nothing to do with religion, usually. So, yeah, well human beings will always find something. But going back to what you were saying about how Sharia is a scare word, and the Obamas and Sharia taking over the United States. This is not an accident, Paul, that people started to feel this way. When I wrote my first book came out in 2008, and nobody knew this word Sharia. I barely spend, I think, a paragraph or two on it in the book because nobody was talking about it. And since it loosely just means Islam, there was no point in spending a lot of excess, you know, text on what it was. But something happened in 2010 that changed all that. What happened is that, so in this country and also in Europe as well, but there's a loose network of individuals and organizations that really make a business out of spreading fear and misinformation about Muslims. They make a lot of money doing it. It's a profitable industry. And it's called the Islamophobia Network, and it's been documented several times. There's a report called Fear, Inc., put out by the Center for American Progress that talks about the prophet and who these people are. But they've been very influential. And so one of the individuals in this loose network, this loose Islamophobia network, is named David Yerushalmi. And in 2010, and this is by his own admission, he wanted to introduce the notion of a scary Islamic law ready to take over the United States. Now, he's a lawyer, and he knows that no religious law can take over the United States because we have a constitution that prevents that. He knows that, but that was really not his purpose. His purpose was to just introduce it into the public discourse, introduce fear of Islamic law into the public discourse. And so he started to go to state legislatures and he started to say, you know what? You need anti-Sharia legislation. Otherwise, Sharia is going to take over the United States. And he started calling it Sharia law. Nobody calls it Sharia law. That's a total construct. But he said, Sharia law is going to take over the United States unless you enact anti-Sharia legislation. Now, this is a colossal waste of time. We don't need anti-Sharia legislation because we have the Constitution of the United States, the First Amendment. So, but that wasn't his purpose. And he knows that. His purpose was just to introduce this fear. And to date, 14 states have enacted anti-Sharia legislation. And this gave rise to all these anti-Sharia protests. And like you said, people saying that Obama was going to impose Sharia or Sharia law on people. And it was really an amazing phenomenon. He was wildly successful, Yerushalmi, and he made a ton of money doing it. he was successful. So now there's this, and actually he characterized Sharia as this rigid black and white ideology. You know, he stoked the fear. You know, Sharia is going to be imposed on you. You're going to have to, I don't know, wear burqas, wear Arab clothing. It was nonsensical, but it worked.
Well, I knew there had to be a grift. I was thinking, and so if they're going to do this legislation, you're going to need an expert on it. He just so happens to be one.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to me that these legislatures just went along with him. I mean, this is what I always think. Like, why didn't anybody just consult an Islamic studies professor? That's all you needed to do. Like, why didn't you just fact check? Like, why did you take his word for it and start enacting anti-Sharia legislation? And it's because we are conditioned to believe the worst of Muslims. It's really easy to believe. It just confirms our negative views of Muslims.
Well, yeah, it's bias confirmation. Also, on the larger scale, it's a failed species. So, but we'll do another show on that. It's a fail. How do we overcome this? You have some good solutions in the book. Do you want to share them with the audience?
How do we overcome just the stereotypes?
The misinformation, the stereotypes, the bad PR, the black PR. How do we enlighten? How do we awaken? Because with knowledge and experience and light, it can't flourish.
Right. So I think the first thing, I think it has to be a many-pronged approach. You know, I think knowledge is power, right? Ignorance gives rise to fear. And fear is a basic primal instinct that we have. I think fear is the strongest emotion that we have. And biologically speaking, there's a reason for that. It kept us safe. But now we have sort of inappropriate, oversized fear. And so an ignorance feeds that. If you have knowledge, if you understand what Muslims believe and how they act, then that is a very powerful corrective. And that's why, of course, I write the books that I write, because I'm trying to explain what Muslims believe, you know, the statistics about Muslims, you know, what the picture is, because we don't get the real picture in this country. We get, again, you know, 90% of stories about Muslims are in the context of violence. So I want to give a bigger picture. And it's hard for people to hear because they are so conditioned to think of Muslims as negative. It's very hard to go against the stream sometimes, but that's the first step. The other step is just to, you know, for example, meet a Muslim. Over half of Americans say that they have negative views of Muslims and Islam, but over half also say that they've never met a Muslim, at least not one that they've realized was a Muslim. So that's another thing we can do. I think we also need to start going beyond this framework. You know, we have this historical framework that's in place. What does that mean? It means that negative stories about Muslims are fitted into the framework. Like you said, it's confirmation bias. Positive stories about Muslims are dismissed. And so we need to have more of the big picture when it comes to Muslims in our media, in our television, in our movies. We need to protest when we see unjust stereotypes. The discrimination is also in the legal sphere. Muslims, for example, are Muslim criminals are sentenced to prison sentences four times as long as non-Muslim criminals who committed the same acts. And Muslim criminals are covered in the media seven times as long as non-Muslim criminals. So it's coming from everywhere. And so we need to speak up when we see stuff like that. And also I think we just need to start thinking beyond the us them mentality and more in terms of all of us, like what's best for all of us. Because, you know, okay, I'm sorry, but I have to bring in Star Trek again. The wonderful thing about Star Trek is that aliens were not people to be feared. They were people, I mean, the Enterprise was out exploring, wanting to make new friends. The aliens were people to be understood and embraced. And I think we need to take that philosophy. We need to start trying to walk in each other's shoes.
That's. I thought you were going to go deeper down the Star Trek realm. And I would say your next book should be about Star Trek and the different metaphors. There's so many metaphors there. I want to ask a Star Trek question. Psychologically, yeah. What part is, who is Spock? Does he rational thought manifest in a form?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a Star Trek expert, but, and I have to say, I've never been to a convention or anything, but yeah, Spock is the rational, reasonable, sensible side. And Kirk is the, you know, the one with flair. He's the one who is emotional and empathetic and inspirational.
Oh, wow. I can't believe I opened the door and you're like reluctant to walk through. All right. I was trying to tee you up on the Star Trek. You're shy about it. I know you have to go soon. Have you personally experienced much abuse just in the last 4 or 5 years? Did it get worse under Trump with all the hate? Have you been harassed, or are you able to move through the world pretty okay and people leave you alone, just are nice to you?
Well, so I think, first of all, I'm not visibly Muslim, which is, by which I mean I don't wear a headscarf. So you wouldn't know that I was Muslim unless you asked me or unless I told you. It's women who wear headscarves who have been much more harassed in recent years. And in fact, you know, people who are not Muslim have been harassed for being Muslim. The Sikh community, because the men wear turbans, people have mistakenly assumed that they're Muslim, and injured members of the Sikh community. So I'm it's not visible racism in my case. When they do find out, they do say all sorts of things to me. I mean, people have asked me why Muslim women are oppressed, for example, and here I am, not oppressed as far as I know. I was a corporate lawyer. But these stereotypes persist even beyond what people see with their own eyes. That's been kind of the problem, is that it's very possible to hate a group of people, but like individuals within the group. We see that all the time, right? I mean, I hear people say, oh, I can say what I want about Black people. My best friend is Black. And that, I mean, that's not legitimate, because I've had friends who were extremely, extremely negative about Muslims and had all kinds of stereotypes, and yet were very kind to me. So there's a definite dichotomy there in the way that people view Muslims. I think we need to be portrayed more as less other, less foreign. I mean, people still ask me, oh, where did you grow up? Oh, you're Muslim? Where did you grow up? And I say Los Angeles. But the assumption is I must have grown up somewhere else. I must not be American. Or people have actually said to me, oh, you're Muslim? I can hear that you have a foreign accent. Can you believe this, Paul? So there are some very, very basic misconceptions and stereotypes that can easily be overturned with some effort. I have to say, one of the most wonderful examples of this is a television show called Legends of Tomorrow. Do you know this show?
I don't.
It featured the first Muslim woman superhero on television.
You're hysterical with your Star Wars and your superhero stuff, and you won't talk about it, I think, because somehow it might affect probably your academic career.
I don't go on at length, but I was watching the show and I was so stunned to see a Muslim woman superhero. Traditionally in film and television, Muslims, even when they're portrayed positively, they're only portrayed positively if they're stripped of their Muslimness. So the good Muslims are the ones who are secular or who are fallen away Muslims or who don't practice. The bad Muslims are the religious ones. And it drives me crazy. Because you can be a good Muslim. I'm a moderate Muslim. I'm perfectly comfortable in American society. And so when I saw this show, I couldn't believe it, because here was this Muslim woman superhero who you know, was cranky one day because she was fasting for Ramadan. It was amazing. It was mind-blowing. I had to say it.
That's clever. I think I can honestly say you don't have a Muslim accent.
Well, thank you. I don't.
Whatever that would be anyway. What a dumb idea.
Standard West Coast accent is what I've been told.
Very LA, very West Coast. Hey, finally, the last question. For anyone listening who is Muslim or any religion or any place who's experiencing prejudice, injustice, what inspiring words would you say to them to help lift them up today? Because that's hard. It's so unfair. But it is what it is.
Yeah, I think we all get really frustrated, down on religion too. I think even, I know lots of people I grew up with who are Muslim and who have kind of bought into the Western stereotypes of Islam. In fact, I talk about this a bit in the book, but Muslims are colonized in our own minds, where we've bought into the Western stereotypes of us. And so when my book on Sharia came out, one of my father's friends said, "Oh, I'm afraid of Sharia." And my advice is, well, then read about it. Read about what it is, religions were founded in terms of promoting fairness and justice. And we can fight about anything. We can fight about religions. But most of the wars in human history have been about territory and power. Very, very few of them have really been motivated by religion. And this is still the case. Most of what's going on in the world, in the Muslim world as well as non-Muslim, is about territory and power. It's not about religion. So I would say, well, shameless plug here, read my books. Because what I talk about is hopefully not a Pollyanna kind of an approach, but what I talk about is, here's the religion. It's fluid. Religions are fluid. They're interpretable. They have inspiration for anybody who wants to find it. And you don't have to be, obviously you don't have to be religious in order to be inspired and moral. I don't believe that at all. But if you are a religious person, don't take the stereotypes to heart. Do your own reading and understand that, for example, Sharia is not something that requires you to be different from the rest of Americans. In fact, Sharia requires Muslims to follow the law of the country in which they live. So, and this is part of Sharia. Muslims in America are required by Sharia to follow American law. I think that's what I find is beautiful. And also there, at least in Islam, I'm not an expert on other religions, but at least in Islam, there are so many verses, Paul, about diversity in the Quran, and so many verses on forbidding the forcible conversion, the forcible compulsion of religion onto people. So in the Quran, it's very clear. It says there is no compulsion in religion. It means you can't go and convert people by force. And there are many verses on that. And there are many verses on diversity. So can I read you one of my favorites? So by the way, in Islam, you don't have to be Muslim to go to heaven. There's a verse that says, "The Muslims, the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians, any who believe in God and the last day and do good, have their reward with their Lord. There's nothing for them to fear." So this is in the Quran, and it's been totally established that you don't have to be Muslim to go to heaven. So that kind of takes the wind out of the sails of the people who say that Muslims have to convert people or kill them, right? Because what's the point if the other people are going to go to heaven as well? Also, like one of my favorite verses on diversity is, "O humankind, we created you from a male and a female, and we made you into different races and tribes for you to learn from each other. The noblest of you in the sight of God are those of you who are most conscientious." So, this verse is saying we made you into different nations and tribes. And it's not saying go convert the other ones. It's saying we made you into different nations and tribes and races for you to learn from each other. It's reciprocal. And I think that's as good a place to start as any when it comes to navigating our world today.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.